All right, great. So today we're going to talk about the AI for reason.
Yes.
And yeah, so first of all, I would like to ask you, what did you think of the project? How do you think it went?
I think it went well. So it was sort of my dream project. It was this ERC project, which is this high risk, high value kind of projects. I'm not sure, are you interviewing only the ERC project people or all sorts of Horizon projects?
It's all sorts of Horizon projects, but also ERC and just the health projects in general. So,
Yeah, so this is sort of pursue for 5 years your dream topic, and it sort of worked in the end. It worked out for me quite well. Like, I have been doing this sort of work in AI and reasoning for maybe more than 20 years, and this was like when things really started to look hopeful. And we actually managed to show that these things really can be done. So it led to, I would say, several nice breakthroughs in the area that we work in. So it wasn't trivial. Like, it took us, like, the biggest breakthrough took us probably 3, maybe 4 years. But then it really happened, and it worked out very well. So yeah, it went well too. Scientifically, it went pretty well. Yeah.
nice, because I read it was something like 40 to 70% in theorem problem solving or something.
Oops, sorry, that's my
No
alarm.
worries. No, you can take it if you want.
No, that was just an alarm not to forget about you, and like, it's
That's so nice.
yeah. So I don't know, like, how much detail you want, but so what we are doing is automatically proving mathematical theorems, and we then the novelty is that we combine it with machine learning. Like, we sort of simulate humans who read some mathematical textbook, and they gradually learn from solving problems to solve harder and harder problems. And we in the like the biggest breakthrough was that it improved really like a state-of-the-art automated theorem prover in several iterations of learning and proving by 70%. So that was really like a very unusual increase in this sort of area that we got thanks to these combinations that we developed. So that's really, I think it's really something which is sort of going to transform how people are doing automated theorem proving.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Out of curiosity, because you said machine learning, and I thought that machine learning was just itself learning itself to get better and better and better. But how come it took for a while, took you for a while to get there, like to get the first results?
There are many ways how you can set up the machine learning. There are various like choice points, basically. Like, what is it exactly that you want to learn? How will you characterize the state of the automated theorem prover and the choices? Then a very important part is what sort of machine learning you are using. So some people like naively try to use deep neural networks for it, which is like the hottest thing for the last, let's say, 6, 7 years. But they are comparatively slow to the automated theorem provers. So then either you need to have like really big computational resources. But if you do it in a smart way, if you use good machine learning methods that are like, I don't know, 1% the cost of the deep neural networks, then you can actually do these improvements basically in a way where it sort of rolls on itself, and the machine learner isn't slowing down the automated theorem proving. So the I guess the main issue is that the task is like really very combinatorial. Like theorem proving is sort of super exponential, like the search space is super exponential typically. And you need to backtrack quite often. And there are like different ways how to do this, how to organize the proof search. And if you only believe that the machine learning will be perfect, then and it's very slow, then the backtracking will be extremely costly for you. So if it was perfect, then you could go for the very slow methods. But it's never perfect. It's sort of it's a more complicated feedback loop where you need to explore the options that have initially like lower probability. Like you can imagine something like some Monte Carlo tree search where you don't go just for the highest probability thing, but you also need to explore the lower probability things. And all of this is costly, like especially it's as costly as your machine learning guidance is. And if you overdo it with the machine learning guidance and you do not have the resources for finding the right parameters, the right ways, then this research can take you
Yeah,
forever. If you
forever. Yeah.
if you do it wrong, then even like Google scale resources will not save you basically. So you must be cautious basically.
Okay,
And
so,
lucky.
and then you said you did some multiple other projects as well. Did you think you learned from that for this one?
So I'm not sure what exactly you are referring to. Like, you mean within this ERC project, we did other things also,
I
or?
mean, no, I meant right now you did a project for 5 years,
Yeah.
and before this you did other projects. So do you feel
Yeah.
like you've transferred knowledge from other
Yeah.
projects and how they
Yeah.
work here?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So what was working already before this project started? Where so yeah, so I have been working in this area like since my master thesis, basically. And what started to work quite well. So what we did in this project, like the big breakthrough, was that we put the machine learning inside the automated theorem prover. So it's sort of really guiding like every step of the automated theorem prover, every reasoning step. But what we have shown before that is that we can use relatively simple machine learning methods to very significantly improve the performance of automated theorem provers by training which facts it should be using, which sort of initial facts. So if you imagine that you have like a big textbooks which have like I don't know 100,000 mathematical theorems in it. So if you want to prove some new conjecture and you give all these 100,000 theorems to the automated theorem prover, then it will not prove anything because it's really the search is extremely combinatorial and this is too much. But if you do like relatively simple machine learning on the proofs that you already have, and you learn which facts, which theorems are useful for which conjectures, then instead of giving it 100,000 facts, you can give it, for example, only 100 facts or 200 facts. And
Much
this
faster.
really increases the chances of these theorem provers a lot. And we have shown this for several sort of high profile mathematical projects. And we have shown that we can really very significantly improve the assistance to the mathematicians that work with these systems. So that was probably one of the reasons why I got the ERC funding, because there was this initial very good indication that things will be better. Yeah.
Yeah, that it will work at the end. Yeah. All right. So what did you eventually do with the results?
So with the results, what scientists typically do is publish them. That's think number one. Then our results are also like systems that really run. So the results are typically some software which is in some GitHub repos publicly available. Then the some of the results are competing in competition. So for automated theorem proving, there are like yearly world championship in automated theorem proving, where people there is an organizer who puts in some sets of theorems and people submit systems, and then you can win the competition.
Is that a coding competition then, sort of?
This is,
A bit stuck.
competition because you submit the code, I don't know, by let's say end of June, and then the organizer is running the competition with the submitted code, I don't know, in July or August. And then it's like quite a bit of fun because the people who submitted the code, who have been working on the code throughout the year, see how their theorem prover is doing, etc. But during the competition, you are no longer coding. You are just sort of, the coding happens
Yeah, and you're
during.
just waiting and see if it works. Yeah, okay.
And what else have you done? So there are people who really use these systems to prove theorems formally, like where they really want to formally verify that a particular conjecture is true. So there are like large projects that verify some big mathematical theorems. And the some of the systems, like there is like a pipeline from the very like cutting edge research that we are doing to systems that really get implemented in interfaces for these people who really work with these systems, and they automate they sort of automate a larger and larger part of their work. So typically like these are like bigger interfaces where they, let's say, want to prove some crazy conjecture like Fermat's last theorems or something really big. And they sort of divide it into smaller lemmas, and we help them to prove these smaller lemmas automatically.
And then is it then part of the funding model that you made? So like the are you getting money from these projects with them?
Like some people have been thinking about it. And so far the answer, at least for me, is no. Like we weren't trying to commercialize it. But it may happen. I don't know how distant this is, but there are companies like especially Amazon is putting a lot of effort and money and energy into formal verification of software and hardware because they are running really big cloud services like the Amazon Web Services. And they, for example, they secured a full data set. So there are companies. I recently heard that even Apple is doing some sort of formal verification. Google has recently started to invest in some verification and some other things, like they are driven like in the sort of general AI and combining it with reasoning systems. So I have sort of evangelized the Google team back in 2015, 16. I have visited them, and they like sort of since then they are running a team doing similar things. They even gave me some small money in 2017. So I think there there are already like commercially valid uses of what we are doing. For example, this Amazon team is really providing verification of various software and hardware stacks. And this, what we are doing is sort of making these things more real, more applicable, because all these verifications are quite expensive because they require a human expert who will formalize mathematically that some system is secure, that you cannot hack it, for example. And the more we can automate of these mathematical proofs, the cheaper it becomes for these companies who actually do the formal verification to sort of do it for their customers. So if we are really good, if we make our theorem proofs crazy strong, then we will make formal verification of software and hardware really ubiquitous, and hacking will become much more uncommon. So that would be like the dream, basically.
All right, so you didn't actually do it for money, you just did it because you'd like to maybe use it and then give it for free for on GitHub and stuff.
That's yeah. So the funding that we got is sort of really for this blue sky AI research. It wasn't for applied work and for commercialization. There are some funding schemes, especially related to ERC, this ERC proof of concept, that are targeting commercialization. And we were thinking that we could do something like that given the results that we got. But to be honest, like the blue sky research is much more interesting to me at this point. So I'm sort of trying to get more money for doing even more blue sky research.
Blue sky research. Okay, so that's your focus on right now. Okay, again, during the project, did you work with other people or were you just in your own group?
So I built up sort of a new group. I moved from the Netherlands to Czech Republic. I'm originally Czech. I have worked in the United States and in the Netherlands for, I don't know, 8 years of my life. And I have sort of this was like an opportunity when I got the big European funding to try to go back to Czech Republic, which was sort of a bit of a risky move because the Netherlands academia is much more advanced and smooth than the sort of East European academia. But like with this sort of big pile of money, I was like sufficiently attractive for the Czech university to try to make it work for me. So I got better treatment than the normal Czech academia people would get. And I also the money that I had were quite good because the salaries in Czech academia aren't so good. So I could basically offer competitive salaries even to people from the West, like to good PhD students. Like I have PhD students, two PhD students from the Netherlands, and I'm basically paying them competitive salaries. So I have sort of built up a group from scratch here in Prague, and that worked quite reasonably. So the group grew initially from me and let's say two people, and currently the group may be like 10 people, and we even brought more funding, et cetera, et cetera. So this was quite successful. We also like I have been around and I have people around the world with whom I collaborate, and I kept collaborating with these people. So I have a good colleague in Austria, in Innsbruck. So he also got ERC funding, and we really collaborated a lot with his group. But then there are several other groups around the world with whom we collaborate.
All right, and how's that collaboration going? Was that easy to do? Was it hard?
So, for example, with this colleague in Innsbruck, like the collaboration was really smooth because we have been collaborating already before together. With several other groups in academia, it also went really well. What didn't go so well, at least in retrospect, maybe it could have been done better, was the collaboration with the companies like Google, etc. Maybe because I didn't know how they operate, and it sort of probably requires it's a different kind of collaboration than collaborating with people in academia, and you sort of need to be prepared for it. And it's a bit like doing business, and I sort of wasn't prepared for that, and didn't quite understand like what are all the implications and how they operate, etc. So I would say that could have gone better.
I see. Could you like give me one example of how that was different? Different?
Yeah. So, it you need to be you need to be very, very careful and very clear with them. Because I would say these companies sort of channel the researchers working there to be quite, I don't know, success oriented. And like if you do something like when I collaborate with people in academia, there are some sort of unwritten rules that you follow. I know I give you this, you give me that, we do this project together, we are co-authors on a publication, etc. With the Google, it wasn't like that. So I sort of I would say I have burnt myself by assuming that I don't know, I give them something and they give something back to me, but it sort of didn't work like that for them. So they would sort of thank me for giving them something, but they would say that they want to collaborate. But when I told them like, now you give back, they said, well, we don't do this. Or so
Mm, right.
I
Very,
think,
very one-sided.
yeah, the sort of these things really need to be clarified with them upfront and made obvious, and maybe even in a written form. Yeah, it's a sort of a different environment where people are very, very like success oriented, and also like the money there are really much higher than in academia. So it sort of motivates people to really meet their KPIs, meet their performance indicators, and like every promotion is additional hundreds of thousands of dollars on your salary. So you sort of get this pressure, which is not so common in academia.
Okay, I know it's probably not very nice now. I can imagine.
It's a different experience, I guess. Like if you it depends on your career path. Some people just after they do their master or PhD degree, they go for being a software engineer at Google or Facebook or whatever, and the salary is good. And some people go for being researchers at these companies. But it's sort of similar in some sense. Like you are still working in the company, and you are still under this sort of pressure, I would say. And the system sort of works differently from some sort of, I don't know, tenure track style academia where the money is sort of okay but not crazy, and you are okay with that, etc.
All right. And then last question for me, do you have any other kinds of experience you would like to share during the project?
So it was a lot of experiences moving to Czech Republic. I would say the there were good and bad things here. Like the institute here was really a new institute, which was like built up by pretty good team of people. So I would say, given Eastern Europe, this might be one of the best attempts to sort of bring academic excellence to Eastern Europe. So I'm quite sort of proud to be part of building up.
My internet. No.
Experience was that not everybody at the university was on board with that, and there is like a lot of sort of legacy bureaucracy in at the Eastern universities, and also there are all sorts of unhealthy things, like people are like there is jealousy and envy in academia everywhere, but in Eastern Europe it's much more pronounced than in Western Europe or in the United States. So at some point, like, our institute was almost destroyed because of some internal wars between the faculties and like some sort of internal university politics. So that is a part which was certainly interesting, but I could probably do without it. Like it was like, like if you do not know whether you are changing your job and moving back to the Netherlands tomorrow, that then it's not the best environment for people to work. So yeah, there were things like this here. Yeah, I could write a book about it.
But did I hear that correctly? Like the academia in Eastern Europe is physically jealous.
I don't know how to in there are many personal fights, many personal issues. Like I wouldn't say like you have personal fights and envy also in the West, in the United States, in the Netherlands, but it's sort of more controlled and more civilized, and people at some point people agree that they have a like a common goal, and the common goal is to make the university good, and typically the people at the top are relatively competent managers, like the presidents of the university, the deans, etc. And there is like a the at least the university in the Netherlands where I was, like the Radboud University in Nijmegen, was really like I could see that the my bosses and their bosses were all pretty competent people, with their goal being to make the university prosper, to make it attractive for the students, etc. Here it's not always like that. Here it's sometimes the personal fights, the sort of turf wars, take over, and like even like the top university managers can sort of be like these sort of people who are very good at the turf wars and destroying each other, and instead of trying to improve the university, they get lost in these wars here, and it could be a number of things. Like we had the communism here for a long time, and like it's sort of it's a lot of issues. It's definitely an interesting sociological issue. I would also say the governance system that chooses the leaders of the Czech universities is sort of suboptimal when compared to the Dutch system, for example.
And that probably inhibits a lot of progress in academia in general, I can assume.
It really makes me quite unhappy. I would really think that the Czech, like, university law requires a reform, that without it, we will really be in this bad state for longer, and it's really not clear that the selection of the top university managers is done correctly in the Czech academia. Yeah, so it's mixed feelings. Yeah. Some things are nice, some things require more work here.
Well, I appreciate you sharing it though. I didn't know actually about that. But yeah.
Yeah, you might get different views from different people. Like, I shouldn't be complaining too much because, like I said, through this quite a bit, and especially my group was really quite a success, I would say, and our institute is also quite a success. There are really, like, uncertainties. Like, for example, there is not institutional financing, so we all run basically on soft money, on grants. So we, like, in the Netherlands, when you get tenure, you are sort of, you know that you are sort of well taken care of for the rest of your life, unless you do something really bad. Here, you sort of need to continue getting funded, and that sort of is not very attractive for young people who needs to start a family, et cetera, et
Yeah,
cetera.
so they'd rather go somewhere else than maybe.
Yeah. So there are, like, these issues. Like, the bureaucracy here is also, like, we are the Czech Republic is famous for having Franz Kafka writing about, like, the various bureaucratic, and the Dutch students who came here really were surprised that this is still possible, that we have this sort of Kafka style bureaucracy in some levels of the state. And so these are the things which sort of, even if I pay the students competitively, they still get annoyed by some bureaucracy which people wouldn't have to do in the Netherlands, for example. So
So they'd
it's,
rather have lower, less money and then stay in the Netherlands then, yeah.
It's so it's not as bad. I would say Czech Republic is becoming quite a decent country with quite decent, like, healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. But some aspects of living in the country are not very competitive compared to, I don't know, Scandinavia, the Netherlands, et cetera.
Can you see it going there though in the next 10 years, 20 years?
I would hope so. But we sort of need to push for it. So it's, I'm basically every day I'm exposed to the university bureaucracy, and because I have some leverage because I brought a prestigious funding and quite a lot of money, I can say that we shouldn't be doing this and we shouldn't be doing that. But there are really, like, layers of bureaucracy, of people who, when you speak to them, they are sort of well-wishing, but there is this sort of resignation in them which wouldn't be in the US or in the Netherlands, that people cannot change some stupid system, that this is how the bureaucracy, how the Moloch, how the Kafka style darkness wants you to work, the machine,
I mean, I
and they
would say
are
the same if I'm on the top. Then I would say, hey, I can't change it.
and they are sort of resigned, and they sort of refuse to try to change things. And that really, that's a long-term effort to change this sort of attitudes and to make people realize that they are the ones who need to start changing the system. So it's about changing the attitudes of people, which is, like, never Totally easy. I would think that maybe what could help, and I might put some effort into it, is to build like a private university or a private research institute in Czech Republic, because we like these public universities are all in some sort of mindset like I just described. They are sort of governed by this inertia of bureaucracy. And it would be good to have a maybe small, but still an example that things can be done in a reasonable way, basically. And that might be like an example for the others. And then you could tell them, look, it's possible here, so why it's not possible there? So maybe I will try to do something like that if I have energy, but yeah, it's a lot of effort,
That
obviously.
would be really cool if you did it, though.
Yeah, maybe we will. I don't know.
All right.